Nice. Thanks for rolling out of bed to speak to us.
How did you know I was in the fetal position this whole day?
Well, you got some sweet bed hair happening, so
Oh, that's just my hair. Yeah, that's what it looks like when I'm stressfully pulling up on it constantly, which is literally, yeah.
Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
JJ, does that work out for you okay? You're just like, no sign of stress on your body.
No.
Wasn't that the Simpsons episode where Homer was all stressed out and pulled all his hair out? And that's why he's bald?
No, I thought it was because he was a father. I think that wasn't there.
Aren't those the same thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like the whole narrative of him realizing that Bart was like his he lost all his hair because of Bart, because he had to be a dad or something like that.
Oh wait, didn't he like each kid he like pulled out more of his hair? So by the time Maggie came around,
I mean, we could probably Google why is Homer bald pretty quickly and find out. But
I mean, the show's been on for so long, there's probably six storylines that are all different on how he ended up bald.
It's a very good point.
Yeah, no, I haven't been sleeping, but my hair is ridiculous. It is kind of fun. Yours is looking mighty slick. Like, you look very, what's his face? Nicolas Cage-esque.
I don't know if that's a good thing or not.
I don't know either.
Yikes.
Or
I think it's finally gotten through the stage where it goes really boofy. Like at some point when my hair's growing out, it just kind of just goes
straight up, like, only it's like it doesn't have enough weight,
not like froey or whatever, but yeah, it doesn't have enough weight. And even when as it starts to fold over, it kind of like puffs up in the middle of the where it folds over, and then I guess it hits a length where the weight in the ends is long enough to just hold it down. I don't know.
Science.
I just figured I'm not gonna get my hair cut until there's a vaccine, and we'll see where that leads.
Oh, you're gonna look spectacular,
right,
JJ? Yeah, you look all pruned, like trimmed up fancily, very tidy.
You
look put together. How are you put together today?
As an ambassador, he has to look his best.
What are you ambassading?
Yeah. I found out yesterday. I applied to become a CDF ambassador, Continual Delivery Foundation, the CD Foundation, ambassadorship because of the streaming I've been doing, and I got accepted.
Congratulations. Cool.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. But my question is like, I realize that like it's an acknowledgement from the foundation that, you know, you're doing good work for their foundation and things like that. But I know like Kubernetes had ambassadors, that I've heard there's a grayscale, if you will, of quality when it comes to ambassadorship. And obviously I want to be on the better side of whatever that grayscale is. So I want to ask the question, what's a good ambassador? Like, what is expected? Is this just like a merit badge? Like,
it is kind of just a merit badge. It's kind of an acknowledgement that you've done certain things that the community have decided is important. Unfortunately, and I think this is your grayscale piece, is once you know what the community decides is important, you can do just that thing. So I know communities in the past have suffered from where they're like, if you run a X meetup in your city, you'll be an ambassador. And so you have like three meetups, get your ambassadorship, and then kind of just stop doing it. I have seen that in the past. And similar things, that's just one example. of where you can kind of gamify it, and not necessarily gamify it on purpose, but you just kind of do a thing for a bit and it loses momentum or you lose interest or whatever. So I'm not necessarily saying people are bad and doing it just to, you know, put a feather in their cap, but I have definitely seen that happen, you know, on more than one occasion for things. Mm-hmm. So I think what's important is measuring people on their continued like activity. Mm-hmm. And I know, I'm just trying to think, I know like OpenStack didn't really have an ambassador program, but I feel like they did a really good job of looking at your overall activity. And I'm not even sure what, if they had memberships or what it was, but I just remember like
community contributor.
Yeah, my understanding was always had to do with, yeah, your commit level was visible because of how OpenStack was organized.
Right, but they looked at a lot more than just, you know, your Git commit history. Mm-hmm. They were pretty good at collecting information about other stuff you did in the community and whatever. And so they were one of the first where non-devs got pretty good recognition.
Yeah, I got a medal from them. Like an actual medal.
You got a medal?
Did you take a bullet for a distro or what?
For OpenStack. Yeah, hang on.
And that
for those listening at home, JJ is now going through his massive pile of conference lanyards, trying to find his OpenStack medal.
And it does confirm he doesn't wear pants when he podcasts. Visible proof.
At least he's wearing his, is it a CoreOS thong? I think it's a CoreOS thong.
Yeah, this is why we can't have nice distributed systems.
That's right.
Because we put them on thongs. So while he hunts for that, yeah. So as somebody, I mean, I've built a lot of community programs as part of my work. It's been mm-hmm. one of those things I really love to learn. And one of the books in the background is People Powered by John O'Bacon, John O's fantastic. For those who mm-hmm. haven't read any of his books, he's great at designing these systems. So like you ultimately, there's always a trade-off as you think about what you are rewarding and incentivizing. And the risk of any measurement is that people only pursue that measurement. JJ, so what is this award for?
This isn't the OpenStack medal. They gave it out, I think the first time they did it when it was here in Austin. And this was the Community Contributor Award to say that you are giving to the OpenStack. And there's a bunch of them. I think Silky even put me in as the application because of the work I've been doing with OS Ops. So yeah, like this is OpenStack's version, I guess, of an ambassadorship or something like that. So.
Interesting. Yeah. So there are always levels of informal and formal ambassadorships, but you know, they seem to have grown in popularity in our industry in particular, because they're quite effective. Like, you know, it's brand association. And with that, you become, there's quite honestly a sunk cost fallacy that comes in. You're like, oh, I'm an ambassador now, and I don't want to lose my ambassadorship. So what do I have to keep doing in order to keep it forever? And thus you're going to stay invested in the community when there's so many other communities you can be distracted by these days. So right. It, you know, kind of the really ugly sausage making is like, this is designed to keep you a place. And when they're made well, it's worth being there. And I think that's the thing I've always strived for, is like build systems worth participating in and have a damn good name. So you want to put it on your resume. Mm-hmm. Ambassador of CICD-ish things sounds legit, as much as I got that wording wrong. Like it does sound like a cool thing, JJ. Are you enjoying it so far?
I found out also that they have rules about how many they can give to companies, because they don't want to have just like all, you know,
X to be clear, like company. People working at companies.
Correct.
Okay.
And it's the total of three per company. And there is, it's basically the work that I've been doing with their streaming, kind of getting their Twitch stream off the ground and actually having, I think, done six of them and going to be seven next week. where it's enough to kind of show off all the different projects inside of the CD Foundation. And it's, I mean, it's just in essence me just messing with one another and another ambassador learning how to do it. But it's value because as a professional, like, I live and breathe in this technical world every single day. And if you see how hard it is for me to get it to do what I'm trying to get it done, it's actually really comforting to a random Jane Doe out there who's trying to do this and banging their head against the wall trying to understand what's going on. And they see a video of someone who lives and breathes in this every day, realizing that it is really hard. It encourages people to change either it allows to have a really nice data point for feedback, right? Like Tecton's a perfect example of it. It's relatively easy to get going now because we had enough people who came in on the first day, like heebie-jeebies, if you will. Where like, this doesn't make sense. Why am I doing this? Why do I need to know what a CRD is? This is really hard. And then we're able to shave it down. So now you can just run a handful of commands. And before you know it, you have a working pipeline with very little overhead on Kubernetes using Tecton. So there's some real value props there.
Neat. Paul, are you ambassadoring anything right now? Are you in any sort of advocacy programs like these?
I am not. I have applied for the CNCF one a few times. And I've never even had a response from them, let alone an acceptance. So I don't know what the deal is there, because, I mean, I do spend a fair amount of my time advocating for CNCF and Kubernetes related things. But I think it's just, I don't necessarily hit the very specific requirements they have, which I get. Like, you have to have some kind of requirements. Otherwise, it's subjective who you let in, and then it's open to people, you know, interpreting why did you let that person in. But it is very frustrating. And I've experienced this a number of times before, where if you don't fit into the mold of what they expect, then it's very hard to get kind of get the right kind of recognition that you would like to get out of it. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't feel any need to have an ambassador title or something. So if there are other people that are ambassadors that are doing a good job and may want or need that signal boosting to their own like personal brand and their resume and stuff, then I'm not going to lose any sweat over not having them myself. I already have plenty of advantages in my life. I don't necessarily need to, you know, take one that maybe someone else could get more use out of.
I think it's safe to say you're an ambassador for Tire Fire, though. I think it's safe to say at least you have that, right? Do we have a Tire Fire ambassador? I don't think we do. So we should get that for you.
We should start a program.
There make a pin. Like, literally all you need to do is make swag and you have an ambassadorship program. So we could start one right now with the right order. You don't have swag.
Well, Tire Fire has swag.
Yeah.
Well, then you're the ambassador of Tire Fires.
Wait. On your resume. Broberg, you don't know what Tire Fire is, do you?
I do recall that after hearing it again. It's been a minute. I know it's your weird side project thing that's pretty neat. Yeah. You should probably link to it so other people know. Or give a pitch. What is Tire Fire?
Well, it became the easy way to get your Hacktoberfest PRs in, which starts very soon. But it's basically TIREFI.RE.
Did you really just spell Tire Fire for people?
Well, the dot is in a very specific place, right?
Right.
So I'm killing Broberg. I can see it. I probably spelt it wrong too, knowing my luck.
Yeah. Now you got it right. Well, it depends. If you're using the American spelling, you spelt it right. If you're in anywhere else in the world, you didn't, because it's T-Y-R-E.
Are you
killing me?
This today, I was this many years old when I learned that. Really? God, English is so stupid.
It really is.
I mean, you could argue that it's not English that's stupid, just American English.
Well, luckily that won't last too much longer.
Oh, boo. Oh. Boo. Well, let me just quickly TLDR Tire Fire, because it's worth, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's basically a bunch of old sysadmin-y people, developer people, came together and created a static site of in jokes and it, like, really tongue-in-cheek of, like, people who've been in the industry for a while and seen how the different things are. There's even a web ring attached to it too, if you know what a web ring is. And it's fun. It's really easy to get up and going. And because it's such an easy thing to write down, it's fun to kind of throw a tire fire up when something goes, like, on a presentation or something, because it's just like a burning tire fire. And they have different jokes inside of it too. So it's fun.
That's a TLDR.
That sure. Was too long, read more than a synopsis. Yeah.
Oh, I guess that whatever. Is a TLDR. Right. Yeah. That's the TL bit. Now someone did the DR.
Anyway, cool. Tire fires are great. I'm glad you're celebrating them. I am not currently, I don't think I'm in a, oh, I am kind of in a club if you think about it in the broader way in our space. I'm a maintainer of a project under the Linux Foundation called Chaos. Mm-hmm. And I am a contributor to Kubernetes through the marketing working group under SIG Contributor Experience. And since I have commit access to some of the org, that it, I would consider that another sort of unofficial official ambassadorship. So, you know, for those listening, if those are really helpful little things to get on your resume, if you're looking to boost, like, signal boost that you're interested in open source, or you're trying to get into new spaces, a great way to do that is by, you know, slowly earning your credentials by contributing to places.
Yeah.
So I've been advising a number of people who are job hunting right now due to, you know, COVID layoffs, and or they're trying to retool their skills out of, you know, ancient proprietary hardware systems towards something that is software oriented and probably open source. So just felt like that trick needed to get further than my brain and those DMs. Mm-hmm.
It's good. Cool.
Yeah, and if you count that kind of stuff, I guess I am a Helm and Helm chart maintainer, so I do have some.
Oh hell yeah, that's
exclusive
huge.
Clubs.
Yeah,
I was thinking like, you know, ambassador, like, you know, outward reaching versus just helping the project internally.
We're still supposed to use Helm too, right?
I will fight you.
Speaking of that, go for it.
I was just going to say, we do have a workshop coming up in October that is going to be a how to migrate from Helm 2 to Helm 3. So if that's a real question that somebody has, I can try and find a link to that and put that in the show notes.
Anyone out there looking for that? Okay,
crickets.
Cool. Well, let's move on.
Crickets.
Yeah, I mean, I brought up job hunting, and that's been interesting to me. I'm thankfully in a good place. My company is making money and my job seems reasonably secure. Mm-hmm. But I'm struck by the juxtaposition of people I know that have been in steady roles for a few years, maybe like up to 5 or 6 in these technical companies, and they're getting laid off from mm-hmm. what things that they thought that were really solid. While I just starting to see like a widening gap from my group of friends who were in the storage virtualization networking space exclusively to people mm-hmm. that got into open source along the way or went further up the stack. And like that fissure seems to be growing in in the distance that people have to jump in order to go from those kind of roles after they get laid off, and then try to get into what people are hiring for, which are very open source centric from at least the bias I hold in them seeing. Are other people seeing this kind of pattern, or like, or how are you advising people who are struggling to jump into something new?
So I've had a couple handful of people come and ask me for some advice on companies and or, you know, working for specific people that I may have worked with in the past recently, where they've been looking for their next step or whatever. And maybe this is just me being way too conservative, but if, like, what's the story? The best place to be when you're looking for a job is you have a job and you can find a new job, right? Like that's what we should, what 100%. You need to strive for. Yeah, what you need to strive for. Obviously not everyone's that privileged, and but there are people, you know, there are people that are in that position too. I advise, and when I talk to people, kind of try to get their feedback of what they're looking for the next position. With how many variables that are in this world right now, with how much uncertainty that is going on, if you have steady income and you feel confident in your position, obviously to your point, Broberg, there are layoffs happening left and right, but if you feel confident and you have good relationships with your management, I believe that you should stay where you are. Like, don't get me wrong, it might sound conservative and not like career growth wise, because what's the joke, right? Like the way to move up in companies is you change companies, right? Like you don't, very rarely do companies like promote anymore. You have to move to another company to get promoted. Anyway.
I think, I mean, you're bringing up a lot of really interesting points, JJ. Like, but yeah, where are you going?
I was just kind of trying to reiterate that with how many things that are going on in this world, and in the situation that we're in, jumping to another company, if you are already in a safe place, the one thing we don't have right now in this world is consistency and stability. Like, play the COVID card, play the geopolitical statement of this world right now. At least if you have income coming in from a company that allows you to live the life, at least in some level of consistency with employment and money, I guess. Go ahead. Sorry.
Can I summarize? Yeah. What I'm hearing you say is that in your way of thinking about jobs, so it's ideally, if you're job hunting, you're in a job. That's different from the case we were talking about before, but let's focus on this one. And you're saying if you already have a job right now, make the most of your job right now, because for you, that's the rock in your world. Like, that's the stability while everything else is very unstable right now.
Exactly.
I got that? Okay. Because that's really interesting to me, because I think after a couple job jumps that got me huge salary increases and better roles, I got into the habit that, like, to stay still is risky and to keep moving mm-hmm. is the only way to not be at risk. Kind of like more of a shark principle. If I'm not moving, I'm dying.
Yeah.
Because I saw friends that settled into roles and then got laid off, even though they felt really solid there. So I have the exact opposite bias. Like, as everything is uncertain, like, you got to keep moving because wherever you are might not be there for long. And to be clear, I'm fighting that urge. I've had some really interesting job posts come up and be sent my way with referrals and everything, and I don't want to leave right now. I actually really like the team I work with and the work that I do. So I'm aiming for more than a 2-year tenure at a company for the first time in 5 years because I think it's worth it. But that's my bias. It's kind of the opposite of yours, which is really interesting. Yeah. Paul, how do you think about this stuff?
Yeah, I kind of see both of those things. Personally, I have tended to stick at a place for a good length of time. But, like, thinking about it, that's always been because it's been exactly the right place, or also because I have had no choice. Mm. So when I moved to the States, there was 4 or 5 years where I literally couldn't job hunt because my ability to work was tied to my current employer. So that was definitely kind of forced me in that direction. But thinking about it since then, I've probably 2 years has kind of been my max. Thinking through like Rackspace, Blue Box, IBM, and where I'm at now. I guess where I'm at now, I'm just a bit over 2 years, but I've also, through three of those jobs, also gone through acquisitions, and that's kind of like a new job anyway. Mm-hmm. So thinking about that, I'm probably at every year or year and a half getting a new job, whether it's on purpose or accidentally.
Yeah. And even though I'm staying at Red Hat and I enjoy my work at Red Hat, like I got a promotion recently and it wasn't just because I didn't just earn it. I was also asking for it. I was warning like, hey, I'm coming up to a year and a half. And like, I find I need to keep growing, and whether that's in place with new responsibilities, that's fine. But like, I need to push myself to stay engaged. I know that about me. So I was signaling to my boss, my boss's boss, when I got skip levels, like, hey, what's the biggest challenge that we have on the team and how can I try to solve that?
Right.
And that has been very helpful.
You know, it's interesting. That's a skill that most people don't have. Mm-hmm. Either
what's the skill?
Knowing that you can, and then actually pushing for a promotion yourself as the person.
Yeah.
Versus sitting around and waiting for somebody to promote you. Because a lot of people will be pseudo promoted by getting a new job, right? Or or they've been at a job for however long and there's random cycles where things are reviewed and, oh, you're suddenly a manager now. Whoops, how did that happen? But there's that definite case like you were just talking about where you actually have to take it on yourself. And different companies are different. Some places kind of actually expect you to be very proactive about that stuff. I've even seen where, you know, if you're going for a promotion, they expect you to come up with a promotion package that includes, you know, almost like a document.
Job description, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a spectrum. So it's important to know what your company's expectations are around that. And then also like what it is you can do to even work around those expectations.
Yeah. And we're also talking to a very interesting bias that the three of us have not been in like a single, like clearly defined org chart. We're not like on the engineering path where like your engineer level 1, 2, 3 or senior principal, et cetera. Right. Like, I find I have to always put a huge asterisk at the end of my advice because I like to live between org charts and I've gone between engineering and marketing back and forth since I came out of tech support. And, it works for me though. I've gotten a little bit more open about some of the tips that worked for me by writing lately on, I've got a much better blogging setup on my iPad and now it's just like so smooth to just like pop something out and push it right to GitHub and it builds my site. And then I usually copy paste it over to Dev2 to get a little further. So I've just been sharing that stuff because it's been top of mind, especially as I see people I like struggling and want to help them through it.
Nice. Very cool. So actually just curious, and maybe this isn't a sidetrack we want to go down, but like for the folks that aren't in the position that we're in, the folks that have been laid off or are unemployed, what is it actually like to be unemployed in the US? The last time I was unemployed, I was living in one of those like untenable socialist countries where the government pays your rent until you can get a new job. And so my experience is probably pretty different to other people's experience. Now I'm making it sound much easier than it was. Obviously there's bureaucracy and red tape and, you know, the government doesn't want to give you money, but you tick the right boxes and they do. And like, I don't really understand how, like, my understanding is when you're working somewhere, your employer is paying for some kind of like almost insurance so that if they fire you or you leave, that insurance then pays your unemployment or something weird like that. Is that right?
I don't know about that part of the puzzle. Like, what are they doing to mitigate the risk there? Normally, when I think about the insurance that a company is paying for, is that part of your overall compensation package includes some to all of your insurance cost. So they're paying for your medical insurance.
Oh, I don't mean that. Yeah. I don't mean insurance as like a thing. I just mean it's almost like an insurance system, how unemployment works.
I bet they do. I don't know how that works.
Unemployment insurance. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a portion of your money, a portion of your salary, a percentage of it gets, so you get your salary, but your company also pays for your unemployment insurance. So when you leave and or get fired, it's when you get fired or unemployed, there are certain caveats that you can't claim it from the state, where you get a percentage of your weekly salary, which is usually like 40% or something like that of your salary from the state, where you get as living expenses pretty much. So it takes a couple weeks to go in, and that's that whole like when COVID hit, those systems that were overran with COBOL up in New Jersey, because people were trying to put their unemployment in, and that comes from the state, but it's been paid in by your company.
Paid in by you as part of your,
your
costs. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah. So
it's scale, right? I'm pretty sure it's a sliding scale.
Sure. And so the only time I had to do this is in Oregon. So it's also state to state. So there's a lot of your mileage may vary depending on what state you're in. And you know, the only time I've gotten like fired and claimed unemployment from it, it was a weird process. I'm really glad I went through it because it was surprisingly challenging. So anyone saying that like, oh, people are just on unemployment and scraping the system, that's some crap, because I had to like prove that I was applying to other jobs, list out all the contacts that I've made, and explain what I've done to improve my career potential in the last 2 weeks. And then there is still a month and a half delay before I started receiving any of the money. So being surprised unemployed led to being, tight for cash for a couple months. So that's a little scary. And then depending on how benevolent the company is that you're leaving, they might cover your insurance for some window of time or give you some sort of package. But if that's not the case, then you're eligible for COBRA, like a special type of insurance for medical insurance right after, which, you know, in America, if you don't have that and something goes wrong, you'll probably get bankrupt pretty damn quickly. So yeah, it's just a terrifying process that's really awful to people. But yeah, you end up recouping some percentage of your salary while you stress study to try to get a new job. That's my experience. Real crowd pleaser.
I kind of when I lost my job and I was in sort of that situation, I've kind of blocked it all out. I'm not gonna lie, like I know what happened to me, I know I have flashes of memories of those times, but like it actually put me on a different path. One of my good friends at the time, I remember him telling me, it's like, JJ, even though you just got fired and you have huge uncertainty right now, if you had not been fired, you would have never grown to where you could be one day. And it was a really positive outlook on a situation that was soul crushing. And I just had a kid too. I remember she was still an infant at the time. And it was rough. It was real rough.
So I take a little bit of issue when people say things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like
which part?
About my infant child, really?
No. About when someone says, well, if it wasn't for that, you wouldn't be where you are now. mm-hmm. almost trying to give like a bad experience credit rather than giving you the credit for having the grit and the determination to do things different or to turn things around. So I always feel a little bit uncomfortable when someone does say like, oh, it's a good thing that happened because otherwise you wouldn't have.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just doesn't sit right with me.
Yeah, it's a narrative bias. It's literally a cognitive bias that we're prone to as we build narratives in our head. And it is, I think it's called a negativity bias. Yeah, we try to build a positive notion around the negative outcome. And it's hard to escape because it's just so natural to our brains. Like I do the same thing. I had a terrible experience, and because of terrible experience, I drastically changed what I was up to. And in the hard work that resulted from that, I have certainly become a better person by my own standards of better. And I'm happy I am where I am. And I don't know if I would have got there otherwise, but now I'm also like inventing false realities to justify my current reality. I can't prove right. that they're related, but you know, people got a cope, man. So I respect your argument against it. And I also completely empathize with your experience, JJ. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I wasn't taking anything from JJ. I was.
Oh, totally. No, you were giving it to him.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in giving them credit, I think there's also like a little bit of a poke at the story we had to tell ourselves to get through it. So
we all need a lot of therapy. I wouldn't mind just throwing in just a kind of a positive notion on job searching and things like that. Something that I wish I had learned very early on, and I try to pay forward, I guess is the right statement here, is that if you are looking for a job and you are trying to find something, believe it or not, the majority of positions you should be looking through is through your network, because it's amazing how much quicker the short circuit will be knowing someone who's looking for something. That obviously means you need a network. Well, obviously, in a COVID world, it's much harder to network now. That was kind of like one of the beauties of the hallway tracks at conferences and things like that. That's how we all kind of came together. I want to offer, if you are listening to this and you are trying to look for something, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. I have no problem with helping you find something. I know people who are looking for positions. I know people who are looking for relatively high up on things. And even if you don't think you have the experience, putting your hat in the ring or piece of paper in the hat, whatever the saying is.
Whatever old-timey metaphor, we know what you're
exactly.
saying.
Exactly.
Putting yourself out there.
There you go. Perfect. Please, I want to advocate for you. Even if I don't know you, like you're just a friend I haven't met yet. Right. And I just want to make sure that was said.
Well, that's awfully sweet of you. Maybe you just created a new like role for yourself. Are you now an employment concierge?
I'm an employment ambassador.
An ambassador of networking, ambassador. Well, on this point, I've actually kind of kept track of the conversion rates of submissions to interviews in my own job hunting over the years. It's a weird hobby to have a spreadsheet of this stuff. Shut up, Paul. Like, I've seen your Instagram. You don't get to talk to about any hobbies with anybody. Putting hot Cheetos in food is not a hobby. So I found that an average, I call it like a cold job submission, to interview rate, where I just like apply for something and I don't mm-hmm. talk to anybody. I have no contact there. It's close to 10%. So mm-hmm. out of 10 applications, I'd be lucky if I heard from one. And what I found that when I submit a resume, either through, I call it a warm submission, through somebody I know is ideal. But if I submit and then reach out to somebody and try to like ask them to network for me and find out who the hiring manager is, I get closer to a 75% interview wow. rate from that. So it goes from like a, you know, close to snowball's chance in hell type vibe to like an almost guarantee.
That's and bonkers.
It's so wild, which is to your original point, JJ. It's like, it's the importance of building a network, which is so nefarious, because like, if you don't have a network, you can be really talented, but not get a chance. But in that way, I really appreciate your point. It's like, we're offer our privilege to others, mm-hmm. Even if we don't know you very well. That's part of what we do. And I shared that spreadsheet that I made on Dev2 this week, so that other people can copy it and use it as a system to, with the intention of seeing like, where do you get stuck? Do you get stuck because your resume sucks, or do you get stuck because you can't get through the first interview? Like, I come to the conclusion that I'm just bad and no one wants to hire me if I don't have this data to help me navigate that water. And I've helped a lot of people with it. So I hope it can go a little further.
Give me that link. I'll put that in the show notes.
For sure. Link.
Yeah.
So we've been talking for a while now, and I haven't yet had the chance to berate somebody for cooking things bad. So
this is the opposite of all of our episodes. Yeah, totally right. Yeah, what have we screwed up lately?
Right.
well, we're also getting close to that moment of like, should we continue the conversation or actually cut it off? Because we're at that sweet spot of the time that people listen to it. So,
talk about food for 5 minutes. It's just not the right show if we don't do that.
Right.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, so I made homemade hamburgers completely from scratch last Sunday.
You grew the cow?
I did. It was actually venison. I have a bunch of deer in my backyard. And no, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I didn't.
I have fresh venison. Well, fresh-ish. It's frozen from a recent hunt from a friend. So I'm listening to your recipe. Tell me everything.
No. It wasn't then. I was saying I killed the deer. Anyway. So I have a meat grinder. And I normally, I buy some meat. And I also make my own buns. From scratch. Making hamburger buns is surprisingly easy. If you have any experience baking any level of bread, like more so than throwing a bunch of like flour in a bread maker, like if you know how to do any of the in vogue bread making style that we have going on right now, it seems that hamburger buns are actually super easy, comparatively speaking. To what is required from the salt, water, yeast, flour way of doing things. Anyway, where I'm going with this is I grind my own meat. I buy the meat, which this time around I bought some tri-tip meat or cuts of steak or whatever. And I think I did some low-end New York strips to grind. And I like the fat content on it. Because that's kind of where I do. And I grind it up. I put some actually hardcore red seasoning, which is from Jesse Prowls, if you've ever seen it. It's very simple that it is the seasoning you should put on all your meat. It's that simple. There is no other answer. It's just hardcore red. Really? Nothing? Okay.
I mean, we all agree with you. So, well,
yeah, I have a way too large of a bottle of that, and it is
phenomenal. By the way, as of a few days ago, those are now nationwide in your Academy stores.
Ah.
So next time you need to buy a bottle, you can go to Academy, get yourself a bottle of Hardcore Carnivore Rub and a case of the COVID.
Nice. Yeah, because they don't require masks, sir.
She should start an advocacy program or an ambassador program, and all three of us should be eligible.
Agreed.
Okay, so I heard tri-tip. I heard low. You said low grade.
Like I didn't buy like not from like the butcher, right? Like the on the low like a end
frozen. Yeah,
no, not frozen. Not frozen. It's the fresh one. But it's in like the case or whatever. It's not like from the butcher and like the high quality meat.
Gotcha.
I grind it. I throw the seasoning in there, and I throw an egg in there as a binding agent, and. Unfortunately, I misinterpreted how many people were going to eat burgers. So I had 1,500 grams of meat at the end. So each of the patties were about 350 grams each. And if you don't know what that is, that's really fucking big.
So that's about a half pound burger.
Okay.
Yeah.
300 grams, a little bit more than half a pound.
Yeah, it was a lot of meat. And the one thing that I felt like I screwed up most on, and this is where I'm trying to get to the punchline here, which is when I was grilling it, because I put it together, I used the binding agent as the egg, and I made the patty, and then I put canola oil, or the spray canola oil on top of it to kind of make sure it wouldn't stick to the grill, because I did it on my outdoor grill. When it heated up, it broke. Like, there was like cracks in it where I ended up putting like cheese as another like gluing agent to like make sure it didn't fall like fully apart. But that felt like I was doing something wrong. Like,
I've heard so many things you've done wrong. I don't even know where to start. But it sounds like you're at the end of the story. So
yes.
Let me break it down and start from the very top. So you said making buns is very easy.
Yeah.
Now, there are two fairly distinct styles of hamburger. There is your restaurant style hamburger and there is your fast food style hamburger, right? And so what you were making sounds like the restaurant style hamburger, where you have a fairly thick patty, you have like a fairly rich, like brioche kind of bun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's the fast food burger, which is a very flat patty, often called a smash burger. And then you have a very, very soft bun that's you almost don't want to feel it when you bite through that bun, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where you've got like your potato buns, like your Martin's potato rolls, your Hawaiian, is it King Hawaiian rolls?
Yes.
King Hawaiian.
Those are your, like, if you're
like
making...
both, Paul.
If you're making if you're making fast food burgers, that's your like King's Hawaiian or Martin's potato. That's the one to go for. If you're making a restaurant style, that's when you can reach for like a brioche kind of one. Now, the way you described you made your burgers, I would suggest next time you add some breadcrumbs, you add a little bit of milk, you make it into one big burger, mm-hmm. and call it a meatloaf. Because that's where effectively what you've made.
Right? Oh, okay.
So when you either style restaurant or fast food style, generally speaking, your burger should be just ground beef, right? Now, if you go like, or ground meat, you can go for other meats as well. You want about a 30% fat to meat ratio. And so something like chuck is probably a little bit high on the fat. And that's why a lot of people will use chuck and then will use something else to go with it, because you want to get to about 30%. So it's pretty common to do like chuck and like tri-tip or chuck and brisket. Another one that works really well is short ribs. You get like the boneless short ribs, and that works really well from a fat content wise. But really what you want is cheap and flavorful. So any of those cuts that, like, they can be chewy cuts because you're grinding them, so it doesn't matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking for cheap and flavorful. So pretty much anything that you would use as a steak, you probably wouldn't put in burger, because it's probably going to be much more delicious as a nice medium rare tender steak than as like a homogenized lump of burger.
Yeah.
So I would suggest like, you can get just like 30% ground, 30% beef from like the supermarket already ground and go with that. Especially if you're doing the fast food style where you're smashing it flat and you're cooking it well done. If you're going for the restaurant style where you might want to have it like medium-ish with a little bit of pink, you are better off grinding it yourself, because as soon as you grind burger, you're basically any microbes or bacterias that are on the outside of the meat and now ground through the entire meat, right? And so you've now got more places for them to grow and live and not necessarily be killed when you cook it. So the rarer the meat, the rarer the hamburger, the more you should be grinding it yourself.
Okay.
When it comes to grinding it, usually on your grinder, you've got like a small hole and a big hole. I like to use the big hole. And then if I'm doing multiple cuts of meat, I'll actually do it a second time. And that will basically effectively mix them for me. And then I don't have to handle it too much beyond then, because the more you handle it, the more the proteins coagulate. And that's the enemy of a good burger, right? Because then you get into like sausage or meatloaf territory, which have a very different like mouthfeel to a burger.
Such a weird statement. Mouthfeel.
Yeah, I love it.
Mouthfeel is such a great word.
Clearly you don't review beer because mouthfeel is everything.
The other thing is, if you are grinding yourself, you need to keep it as cold as possible at all times, because if the fat goes over a certain temperature, it will lose its ability to kind of stay as fat. And as soon as you start cooking it, it will just render out and you'll end up with a super crumbly burger that kind of has like a mealy kind of texture.
Oh, wow. That's, you just explained so many burgers I ate in the past that I didn't realize what happened there.
So the general advice is like cube your meat up and freeze it to the point where it's not fully frozen, but it's kind of stiff. And if you're doing just chunks of fat, you can freeze them the whole way. In fact, you should freeze them the whole way. And then you also freeze all your grinder plates and bowls and everything, and then grind into a bowl that's sitting in another bowl full of ice, right? It's way more important for sausage, but also pretty important for a good burger to just keep it as cold as possible at all times. Where are we at? Good. So that's it. So now you've got your meat ground. You could just form it into a quarter pound bowl. And you know what? If you like a big burger, jam 2 quarter pound bowls together and call it a half pounder, right? then you have your choice. Do I flatten it the whole way? If you're going to make a fast food style burger, you want a flat top grill, and you just get a heavy duty spatula and you just press down as hard as you can on it and make it as flat as possible. If you're doing the restaurant style, you can do it on a regular like grill with the bars on it or whatever you want. And if you're doing that, then you kind of want to form it into the shape you want before you cook it. And you want to put a little divot in the middle. When you cook it, it actually pulls the edges of the burger in and puffs the middle of the burger out. So by putting it like a thumbprint or divot in the top, you're basically giving it somewhere to grow into, without getting super misshapen and kind of almost like football-y kind of shaped.
Mm-hmm. Again, another thing I have done myself that I now understand.
And then that's kind of it. Now notice I didn't talk about seasoning. I didn't talk about binders. So the only thing you want to do seasoning wise is salt and pepper right before you grill it. So what I like to do is, if I'm using a burger press, I'll put a piece of, like deli paper in the burger press, put the burger down, fold the deli paper over and press it. And that way the burger is inside the deli paper. I'll lift one side out, salt, pepper, flip it, pull the paper off and salt, pepper, and like directly onto the grill. And that's all you want. And I could keep going on, but I think I've probably droned on enough about burgers. Unless anyone has a specific question about anything I said.
No, I'm sesame, like really looking.
Sesame seeds or no?
Personal preference.
I both look forward to a good pub burger or a good fast food burger and JJ's meatloaf. I now have three things to look forward to.
You'll enjoy my meatloaf, huh?
Yeah, dude. You cook it that way.
So real quick, watch the current season of The Chef Show. They make a pretty good burger based on Holman and Finch, which are a restaurant in Atlanta. And then also, I think Chad's Barbecue did a pretty good job of doing burgers as well. But I think he did like smoked burgers, so it's a little bit different, but the grinding and stuff is all the same still.
Cool.
Oh, and there's a guy on YouTube, I think he's for First We Feast, called The Burger Historian, and he does some really good stuff too. He actually goes back to like old like 1930s, 1940s style burgers and sort of recreates and talks about how they were different, which is kind of fun.
All right. Well, we all have homework for this weekend. read up on burgers, watch videos and burgers, and make a damn good burger.
Yep.
So with that, thank you all. Good luck to your jobs and your food and your ambassadorships. See you next time.
Bye.
Peace.